Whether you're a member of the greatest generation, the silent generation, that was my parents' generation. Whether you're a baby boomer, a member of generation X, Y, or Z, some of these expressions will no doubt mean something to you. Yeet. Woke. Oof. Gucci. Bach. Beast mode. Lit. Cray cray. Peeps. Diss. The bomb. The bomb diggity. The bomb.com. Coolio. Gnarly. That's my generation. You like that one, don't you? Gag me with a spoon. Fly. Chill. I dig it. Catch you on the flip side. Far out. Out of sight. Ginchiest. Antsville. Daddy-o. Groovy. I'll be a monkey's uncle. The bee's knees. Every one of us in this room probably recognized at least some of those terms, and more than recognized them, some of them we really identified with. They stir something in us. Why? Because they were the terms used by our generation. My topic this evening is bridging the generation gap, and the title assumes that there is a gap other than age between generations. And there is. We just saw one. The generation gap is evidenced in part by a communication gap. I have no idea what some of those things mean. It is interesting that the term generation gap is not very old. It didn't appear until the 1960s when the younger generation at that time, now known as the baby boomers, seemed to go against so much of what their parents believed with respect to music, political ideology, moral values, etc., etc. And it was such a striking divergence from the patterns of previous generations when the upcoming generation would by and large accept what the previous generation offered. It was such a striking difference from that it was duly noted and it was named. We now had a generation gap. Sociologists today who talk about this sort of thing don't prefer the term generation gap. They like the more cumbersome phrase, institutional age segregation. You know. But that term's useful because it offers my segue. That's where I'd like to start tonight. We're talking about bridging the generation gap. I'd like to begin with age segregation, because I believe, and I believe history bears out, that this generation gap is in large measure due to institutionalized age segregation that has been developing in our culture for some 170 years. And I think it might help us to see how we got here. It hasn't always been this way. If you're my age or older, or even a little bit younger, and you come upon someone, let's say someone who's 15 or 20 years younger than you are, you've never met them before, but you choose to have a little bit of intergenerational discussion, the first thing you probably ask them is, what's your name? I'm so-and-so, what's your name? And what's a good chance the second or third question we're going to ask? How old are you? Why do we ask that question? Because we live in a culture that puts a lot of stock on age. The most common and frequent celebration in our society is the birthday party. Do you realize it hasn't always been that way? Diaries and memoirs from the mid-1800s reveal, when people were writing in their diary about what was going on in their life, they look at all these diaries and they reveal that in the United States up until the mid-1800s, people didn't even recognize birthdays, or if they did, they did not observe them. That was the reality in many American homes, but diaries from a later period show that birthdays were given a great deal of attention and a lot of references are made to them. Did you know that Happy Birthday, that song, did not even exist until 1924? What did the people do? We live in a culture where age regularly serves as the determining factor concerning when we can and cannot do certain things. The law says you must begin to attend school when you're 7 or 8. You must attend until you're 17 unless there's some special circumstances. We make a big deal when someone becomes a teenager. Do you realize that's a fact of our language? If we spoke another language, 13 wouldn't be special. But we make a big deal about age. In many families, a child can only begin to date once he or she has reached a certain age, 15, 16, 35. With the few exceptions, You can't get a job until you're 14. You can't vote until you're 18. You can't buy a handgun or a drink until you're 21. Age, a number, is viewed as a rite of passage, as the determinant for whether you can or cannot do a thing. We say, act your age. But has it always been this way, to this degree? Has age always been the determining factor, the hard and fast organizing principle in our institutions and attitudes that it is today? It has been very interesting to me to learn that the answer to that question is a resounding no. Let's take a trip down history lane. Before 1850, Howard P. Chudikoff, in his book, How Old Are You? Age Consciousness in American Culture, he writes this. Before 1850, age held considerably less importance than it would assume in the 20th century. Now, it wasn't ignored altogether. According to our Constitution, you have to be 25 to be a member of the House of Representatives, 30 to be a senator, 35 to be a president. But in that culture, back there in the early 19th century and previous to that, knowing an individual's age did not automatically provide you with any insight into their roles or their social standing. For example, many states in our country did not have or they did not enforce laws requiring parental consent for individuals marrying at young ages. So here's a 15-year-old young lady and a 16-year-old young man, and they go to get the marriage license, and mom and dad are not even involved. Organizations like militia companies and literary societies, some of them had set ages for membership, but they were often ignored. There was a vague acknowledgement of different stages rather than ages of life. For example, in the literature of the time, you read references to youth or manhood, ladyhood, old age. But hear how vague those are. What do we talk about today? Tween, teenager, 20-something. We're very age-conscious, and we've broken it up into a lot more periods than they did in the past. Middle age was seldom spoken of as a separate stage of life before World War I. And the term youth could apply to practically anyone between the age of 7 and 30. In a culture like ours, that's almost unbelievable. But that was the case. And interestingly, it's the case with a number of biblical terms as well. And what went hand in hand with this less age-conscious worldview, and this is where it gets really interesting, was a less age-segregated and more age-integrated intergenerational culture. For example, in the family. Family itself reinforced the idea of age and generation integration. In a rural American home, 170 years ago, the family was typically much larger than a modern American family is. It was not uncommon to have children who would be 20 years apart. So you would grow up with a lot of different ages. The parents was not uncommon at all for parents to be 8 or more years apart. You might have grandparents living in the home with you and servants. You had people of all these different age brackets. And when the day began, they didn't all go in separate directions. What were they doing? They were working on the farm together. They lived together, they worked together, joint effort by all these different people from all these different generations. And the different jobs on the farm, it wasn't decided, well, you can do this job when you reach a certain age. And it probably isn't done that way in hardly any farms today even. It was done, are you big enough to do it? Are you strong enough to do it? Do you have enough experience to do it? Do you have the mental good judgment to do it? But that maybe had a little bit to do with age, but it had far more to do with other qualities. And then you lived in a home not only with all those people, but it could get kind of crowded. So instead of having a bedroom where as soon as you walk in and you see the Transformer poster and everything else, and you know someone between the ages of 8 and 10 lives here, you might have someone sleeping in the same room with grandma. Even the bedroom was intergenerational. Much less focus on something age-specific. In education, it was so different. There were no age norms governing how or when children were educated. There was no uniform age about when you were supposed to go in or when you were supposed to come out. So you walked into a one-room schoolhouse, and what would you have found? You find young children studying right alongside with teenagers, maybe way up in their teens. And then when it came time for recess, what happened? All of them went outside. And the same intergenerationality you saw under the roof, you would see outside of the roof. And the activities they engaged in would be multi-generational. All young and old would be playing together. I'm sure it wasn't that way all the time, but it was that way some or much of the time. How very different from today. When I went to school, I was in third grade. Recess was with third graders. When I was in fifth grade, recess was with fifth graders. And never did the twain meet. It was all very specific and segmented. It didn't used to be the case. Colleges were much more age-integrated than they are now. It was not uncommon for a 14-year-old boy to find himself at Harvard or Yale. Yes, 14. At Harvard or Yale, already knowing his Greek and Latin, by the way, attending school with men in their mid-20s. And the staff might even be younger than some of the students. Lots of overlap. Rather than the strict age stratification, which we've grown so accustomed to, age integration was the rule of the day. Bear with me while I dwell on this a little bit longer. Social gatherings, particularly in rural communities, generations joined together for the fun. You might go to a quilting party up in upstate New York. And yeah, if you'd walked into the room, you would have seen there were young folks in the room, but they were not separated from the old folks, and they were doing the same things as the old folks. At play parties, these social gatherings that were very common among American pioneers around 1830, you'd come into these events, there were games and songs, and yes, there were specific activities for different generations, but again, they were done together. For example, one of the games that was played, you'd have young couples dancing around a ring, and there'd be a young male in the middle trying to steal a partner, and no, that's not me signing off on dancing, but that was the game. Well, here's what the young people are doing. Where are the older people? Where are the children? Surely they're over somewhere else doing their own thing. No, they're gathered around, stamping and clapping as part of the game. Yes, different people did different things, but they did them together. What was the result of all this? Because those of various generations shared in the same experiences and activities, because they talked and worked and played together, there was very little opportunity for a gap to develop. Age groups weren't isolated from each other, and therefore subcultures were far less likely to develop. You know, if we were to take everybody in this room, split it right down the middle, and we're going to have to go out, so we're going to have to pretend we don't have television and the internet and all that stuff, because that's changed everything with respect to what I'm about to say. So let's pretend, let's go back 100 years ago, and we're going to take all the people in this room, and half of us are going to stay here in Des Moines, and the other half of us are going to be moved down to Houston. And we're going to live there separately without the benefit of the modern technology that keeps everybody in contact. We're not all listening to the same accents and all that stuff on the radio and television. We're just going to live separately. 100 years from now, our descendants here in Des Moines will talk differently than our descendants in Houston. This is why an Australian sounds different from a Brit, and it's why we sound so different from Brits. When you isolate people, changes start to happen. We have a lot of subcultures in our culture, and we have some even in the church. How do we know there's subcultures? We've got different vocabularies, different clothing. Isn't that interesting? That just because I'm of a certain age category, I dress a certain way. It hasn't always been that way. Different humor, different interests, different loyalties, different values. Subcultures are not wrong, but at best, they encourage distance, and at worst, they encourage disunity. What changed that state of affairs I was just describing 170 years ago? A lot of things. And we don't have time to talk about all of them, and I don't claim to know all of them. Many of the changes, though in my opinion misguided, were not morally right or wrong, but they did have unforeseen and unintended consequences. Let's talk briefly about it. The Industrial Revolution came along. Nothing wrong with the Industrial Revolution inherently, but it came along. and mechanization came with it. And whereas before, if you were a young boy, you got apprenticed to someone who was maybe much older than you, and you were very used to working side by side with someone of a completely different generation, and you lived and worked in the adult world, by the way. But now mechanization comes along, and your craft is outdated, and the apprenticeship is no longer needed. And your master, he can't even get a job anymore because his craft is not needed, and he's too old to run the machines because he's not fast enough or doesn't have the resilience to do it. The Industrial Revolution forced older workers out of some trades. It forced younger workers out of the apprentice system, and they couldn't handle skilled labor. And so what before, in some trades, you had one mass of integrated humanity. Now you had three different groups. Workaday world was changed dramatically. The world of education started changing hugely in 1850. Up until 1850, there were no compulsory school attendance laws that erected this boundary between childhood and schooling and the adult and work world. But beginning in the 1850s, public school systems began to be established. And I'm not saying that's inherently bad. By no means am I saying that. Please don't think I'm saying that. But these are historical realities. And they began to say that you must enter school at 6 or 7. That changed something. Furthermore, in the 1850s and 1860s, not only did were they saying you had to enter school at such and such an age, but then they began to develop age grades. You know, my grandmother learned to read or taught from old McDuffie readers. Anybody remember those? All right. And we call those graded readers. And when you and I hear the word grade, we automatically think age. But that was not necessarily what was meant. It just meant, as you're learning to read, be you 6 or 16. This is first grade, and then you move up to second grade, and you move up to third grade. Well, what began to happen in the 1850s and 60s is it wasn't just grades anymore. It was age grade. Since you have to enter in at 6 or 7, now we're going to determine how fast you move and when you move. And with that came a change in architecture. Just before this, most schools in the United States, even in the cities, had been one-room schoolhouses. But many new schools began in the 1840s to be designed to facilitate this new organization. And one of the most common, or the most common building constructed in the last half of the 1800s, in other words, it was the standard school building, you still see them standing in certain places. There are 3 floors, 4 rooms to a floor. Notice the difference. Instead of growing up and being educated in an environment where with all these different age groups and you're all doing it together, my mom and dad both went to one-room schoolhouses. Probably a number of you in this room did too. Now, you go to a building where you're separated off by age, you're in 3 different floors and in different rooms. Segmentation was beginning to be institutionalized. And as larger percentages of young people attended school, and as junior highs and high schools and colleges began to proliferate and make education longer, and as peer-based extracurricular activities expanded, what happened? Peer association, age peer association, rather than intergenerational association, filled people's lives. And it habituated them to that as the norm. It changed the way we saw the world. Changes happened in the families. This is really interesting, I think, what I'm about to share with you. Because you now have people growing up, spending huge parts of their day and a big chunk of their life with only people of the same age, something happened with respect to who people married. People started courting and marrying only people within 1 or 3 years of their age. Whereas before, there'd be big gaps far more frequently. Now, people stuck with people at the same age. Now, is there anything inherently wrong? No. But it is interesting. Now, people with basically the same cumulative experiences were coming together. There's a lot more we could say about that. We'll move on. Our culture was building generation gaps. It was driving wedges between previously age and integrated groups. And then to add insult to injury, pensions came along and people had money that they didn't have before and they could retire. And we had the development of old age homes. In Massachusetts, for example, from 1864 to 1904, over a period of 40 years, houses like this swelled from 26% to 48% of the population of those in that age group. In other words, it doubled. So you've got those who are, you come in, you only do, you stay with your own age group all the time, and then you come into a work world where none of those people are in it, and you work with, there's a pretty broad range there. But then the older are separated from society as well. What a huge shift all this brought about. I've gone a long time. I'm almost done with this part. The overall effect was this. Our culture has come to a place where it makes a bigger deal about differences in age groups than it does about the differences within those age groups. We have become about something somewhat superficial, almost focusing on a group rather than the individual. And we spend so much time insulated from those of other age ranges that it has narrowed our experiences. Whereas before, 170 years ago, I would have grown up in an environment where I was experiencing people who'd seen all sorts of things, had all this experience, and I would have had all this multi-generational input coming into me as I was growing up. Instead, we spent all this time insulated from other age ranges. It's narrowed our experience. It's limited our exposure to ideas. It's given us less in common with people from other age groups. It's drawn us closer to those of the same age group and pushed us away from people of the other age groups. And so here we are in 2019 talking about bridging generation gaps. Gaps that did not exist nearly to the degree in the past. This is hurting the church. Here's what older brethren write to me. Some of the senior citizens, says one sister that I know, some of the senior citizens that I know often feel sidelined as though our views and opinions are irrelevant. Irrelevant to who? The young. One brother writes this. These are people in the retired age of life. One brother writes this. One challenge is to deal with the increasing sense that I am becoming invisible to those of Generation Z, those who are in teenage years right now. He says, they flow around me like creek water around a rock. No eye contact or acknowledgement. Now, that may not be typical of everyone's experience, but this word invisible keeps cropping up. One woman wrote this to me, you begin to feel invisible, is a remark I hear from many. It's because you feel overlooked and no longer important. No longer important to who? The younger. What does God want from the older? Among other things, Psalm 71, beginning in verse 17. Oh God, said the psalmist, you've taught me from my youth, and to this day I declare your wondrous works. Now also when I am old and gray-headed, oh God, do not forsake me until I declare your strength to this generation. But it's kind of hard to declare the strength of God to the next generation when the next generation is so separate from you and they don't really feel like you have any role to play in their life. And the young are missing out. Not only on that guidance and that perspective and that wisdom, but I would argue, brethren, the young are missing out on one of God's designed stimulus to maturity. What does Psalm 13, verse 20 say? It says, whoever walks with the wise becomes what? Wise. Whoever walks with the wise becomes wise. But the companion of fools will suffer harm. I'm going to become like the people I spend my time with. If I rub shoulders with certain people, they're going to begin to rub off on me. If I'm young and I spend the majority of my time around the young, where is the stimulus to mature? Where is the stimulus to adopt an adult perspective, begin to see the world through wiser eyes than those who have the same experiences than me? Could it be that this generation gap is one of the contributors to the prolonged adolescence we're seeing in our culture, and sometimes in the church? There seems to be a slowness to grow up, a slowness to assume an adult perspective. Might it be that part of that's being driven because there's just too much separation and not enough integration, not enough time spent with those who are wise? How can we make a situation like this better? Isaiah chapter 8 verse 20 says, to the law and to the testimony. That's where I want to go. What does the Bible have to say. That has quite a lot to say, and I've got to get through it fast. The Bible teaches us, it paints a picture for us of age integration. The very first feast that God ordained for the Jews, the Feast of the Passover, it was the first feast of every year. And who was involved in it? The whole family. Exodus 12, verse 3, it was for a household, that lamb. And the parents were even instructed what to say when the children asked, because the children were there. God intended this event to involve all these different generations in the home. Other feasts were practiced the same way. God specifically states of the Feast of Tabernacles in Deuteronomy 16, 14, you shall rejoice in your feast, you, your son, and your daughter. It's going to be a family affair. Elkanah practiced it this way. That's Hannah's husband, remember? He would take his sons and his daughters, all his sons and his daughters, through Peninnah. The law, Deuteronomy 13, starting in verse 10, the law was to be read every 7 years in the hearing of all age groups. All Israel, God said, all Israel, gather the people together, men and women and little ones. I know a little bit about dealing with little ones, and I know it's not easy. I mean, Lord, you're asking us to sit and listen to the reading of the law, the whole law. And my whole family's supposed to be there. It would really be a lot easier, Lord, if we could, you know, put the little ones over here so I can listen. Get everybody together, says God. When Joshua read the law in Joshua 8:35, it says there was not a word of all that Moses had commanded, which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel with the women, the little ones. They were all there. When Jehoshaphat prayed with the people in 2 Chronicles 20:13, when the enemy was coming and they didn't know what they were going to do, it says all Judah with their little ones, their wives and their children. When Joel called the nation of Israel to repentance in Joel chapter 2, he said, you need to consecrate a fast. You need to call an assembly. Gather the people. Sanctify the congregation. Assemble the elders. Gather the children and the nursing babes. Bring them all. This is a spiritual event. This is one of the most important events in your entire life, and it's going to be an intergenerational family affair. One of my favorite passages right now is Zechariah chapter 8, verses 4 and 5. Zechariah is trying to give hope to the people as they're rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. Jerusalem lies in ruins. A city that had once been bustling and all kinds of activity and beauty, now it's lying in ruins. And here's what God tells these people to give them hope. Zechariah 8, beginning in verse 4. Thus says the Lord of hosts, old men and old women shall again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each one with his staff in his hand because of great age. The streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets. You know, as cities go, that's a beautiful picture. The old men and the old women are sitting where? In the streets. And where are the boys and girls playing? In the streets. They're together. Jesus himself, when the little children were brought to him, his apostles thought that was a waste of time and inappropriate, but it says he was greatly displeased. Mark 10, 14. And he said, let those children come to me. And he took them up in his arms and he gave them of his time and he blessed them. The Bible talks about intergenerational activity, bringing people of different ages, different stages together. It says a whole lot more than just that, but I'd better not. It does tell us how to interact with each other. The younger are to respect the older. I was talking with a brother about this just a couple days ago, 3 days ago, I guess it was. Can you imagine the difference in this nation if we changed just that one thing? If parents successfully taught their children to respect people in authority, I mean, that would be a huge impact that would have on the nation. We are commanded to respect our elders. If we lived under the old law and one of the many gray-headed souls walked into this room, what were we supposed to do? Stand. Don't you stay in your seat when someone of age walks in. You show them respect. We need to continue that. We need to teach our children that. And the older are commanded to love and yes, respect, although of a different kind, and offer kindness to the young, just as they would to everyone else. And I want to touch on this before we close this. Let's not make assumptions. Let's not underestimate what the younger have to offer. And I'm talking about the younger members of the church, those we often call teenagers, maybe even preteens. Let's not dumb down what we teach them. This has been observed by some among the younger generation. They have at times felt like what they were taught was dumbed down. It was watered down. Their brains are quicker than ours. Let's remember and appreciate that God uses all age groups for his work. It shall come to pass in the last days, says God, that I will pour out my spirit on what? All flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions. Your old men shall dream dreams. Instead of thinking of young people as those who will someday take the place of the older, which we do hope they will, but instead of thinking of them as just that, let's think of them as those who can take their place now. How old was Daniel? How old was David? How old was Josiah? Josiah is 16 years old. And he begins to seek the Lord. He's 18 years old, and he is overseeing the refurbishing of the temple. And by age 20, he's leading the nation and tearing down the idols and the idolatrous places of worship. I mean, the stories of, many of the founders of this country. I don't want to scare anybody, so parents, if you think I make a mistake here, please clear it up with your kids. Because I don't want to lead us to make any foolish decisions. That's not my point, but I do want us to see something. God is all wise, right? Right. What is God telling us when our bodies at 15 years old are ready to bear children? What is he saying? He's saying you are capable of this responsibility. Not that you should under these circumstances we're in right now, but the raw material is there. I'd like to speak tonight, before I close, to those of you who are, let's say, 15 to 19, 14 to 19. Over in Asia, farmers are still using elephants to do much of their work. They're nice for pulling stumps and hauling off logs and all that sort of thing. Amazingly, amazing animals. They don't have the benefit of all the automation that we have. In some of those countries, they hold elephant festivals. What these elephants, they'll have them handle, they'll play basketball and soccer with giant balls. They'll have them choreographing, dancing to music. And the main event, they're celebrating these animals. The main event at these elephant festivals is a tug of war between one elephant and 100 grown men. 100 grown men. Now, a very, very, very modest estimate of weight means we've got one elephant pulling against 7 tons of full-grown humanity. And you know where this is going. Every year, the tug of war takes place, and every year, who wins? The elephant wins. The strength of this animal. So you own an elephant. You're one of the privileged few who owns an elephant. It's time to take Bubba home. And you've got to keep him somewhere. But you don't have a big reinforced steel cage like they have at the Kansas City Zoo. So what are you going to do? How are you going to make sure this elephant doesn't go anywhere? They put a stake in the ground. A stake. And they tie a rope to that. And then they tie the rope around the right rear leg of the elephant and they go to bed. And when they get up in the morning, the elephant's still there. Now, why is that elephant still there? It's certainly not because of the rope. That elephant is there because of something that elephant believes. That elephant believes he's tied down. He can't get away. If you're still listening, 14 to 19, I believe you are those elephants. You have been told a lie by our culture. And that culture is that your teenage years are about waiting. Your teenage years are about having fun, just doing things that kids do, and you can be an adult later. But what your body is telling you and God is telling you and biblical examples are telling you and almost all of human history is telling you is that that's not so. You are capable of assuming real responsibility, and not only are you capable of it, it's what you ought to be doing. What do I mean by that? There's work in the kingdom of God that's much easier for you to do than it is for some of us. Well, some who are older. I'm going to hedge on that right now. I'm good right now. Maybe it's not too far away, Lord willing, but right now I feel pretty vigorous. Go to your eldership. Say, you know what? I would like to step in and help in the work of the kingdom. What can I do? And if they give you something small, prove yourself and come back a couple weeks. What can I do? If you're of driving age, why not go visit a widow? Why not go visit someone who's in the nursing home? Well, that's not something a teenager does. Who says? You know, I was with Brian Miner. Some of you knew Brian. He's passed away now. When I was a teenager, I was with Brian one day. We were driving or riding our bikes around his neighborhood. He didn't live too far away from Bill Ford. It was a Sunday afternoon. This would never have occurred to me. I was pretty shy at that point in my life. Brian goes, go visit Bill. Okay. We stopped in, knocked on the door. Bill let us in. We visited with Bill Ford. I mean, I don't know how many years between us and Bill, about 40. I imagine Bill remembers that. You can do that. If there's a work day at the building, as I'm sure there probably was, or sometimes is, getting ready for a meeting like this and others, join in. If there's work to do during and after the meeting, join in. I imagine there may be people in your congregation who you just know you can always count on and they'll do it. Why don't you become one of those? Go up to them, sister, I'd like to be involved. What can I do? What responsibility can I assume? Mom, Dad, would it be okay with you if I took the car next Saturday and instead of going out and hanging with my friends or playing video games, if I went to the church and went to the building and helped the brethren get the building ready? Yes, son. That'd be great. Start a Bible study. Brag on my wife. Amber was in high school, at least some in high school, and there were some people she was meeting who had an interest in the Bible. They started a Bible study. Now, thankfully, Gerald Clevenger was there, and he was able to get them a room. School would end, and once a week, they would have a Bible study that she was guiding, which I believe is perfectly acceptable in God's economy, in that context. I know there may be some of you in this room, I'm almost sure some of you in this room were a part of this, but four, five, 6 years ago, there were several college students who on a weekly basis were getting together on Skype and having a weekly Bible study. Who can be the one to start that? Or plant the seed. Offer to help with the advertising of your congregation. Maybe you just want to get the word out to the neighbors. Hey, can I put it, brother so-and-so, would it be okay if I kind of designed the flyer? I'll bring it to you. You can tell me what you think. If it's okay, I'll start passing those around the neighborhood. I'll just stick them in the door. Would that be okay? Well, sure, that'd be okay. All kinds of things. And we who are older, when these young people step up, as I'm sure some of them will, some of them already have, when they step up and they come to us or they start showing signs of wanting to do this, what's our responsibility? Our responsibility is to encourage and be thankful and to mentor. I will tell you a personal, I blew it 3 years ago. I shared some thoughts along these lines with a bunch of young people. They got on fire. They came to me and they said, we want to put together a weekend meeting. We'll handle the whole deal. I was like, okay. They put together a form, a sister wrote it out, a bunch of them signed the paper, they mailed it to the eldership of the congregation that I thought might be the most likely to accept it. The eldership said, yeah, we'd be willing to host that, you make that happen. But the meeting didn't happen. And one of the reasons I realized too late, these are young people who have the ability to assume a lot of responsibility, but they still need some older folks to mentor them and show them how. Duh. So that's our job. All right, you want to learn that? Great, I'm with you. In fact, I've got another idea. Would you like to go along? I'll show you. Hey, I'm going canvassing next Saturday. I'm scared to death, but I'm going to do it anyway. You want to come along as a silent partner? Silent, right? Silent. You don't have to do any talking. Come along with me. Okay. I'm going to close with this. these gaps, these chasms that exist between generations. Let's take the Bible seriously on this. And let's find ways to keep generations integrated. Let's do it in our home. When you have another family over to your home, just plan it ahead of time. You got to work it out. But instead of having the old folks in the living room just having all the conversation and the young people off doing their own thing the whole time, hey, why not create a conversation that everyone can participate in? Hey, I got a question for you guys. I mean, you come to church every Sunday. What do you see? What do you think your friends see? I mean, there's all kinds of things we can ask. Get their input. Let's listen. Classes are fine. They are a liberty we have in Christ. Small groups are beneficial. But how about we try designing them around something other than just age? How about designing them once in a while just around subjects? Hey, we've got these 4 or 5 classes here. This is on this subject. This is on this one, this one, this one. Anybody can go to those. Let's put some families together. Okay, this is group 1 for this month, families A, B, and C, and families D, E, and F, and then next month we'll switch them. In our adult class, when our young people join in, let's welcome their questions. You know, young people do feel sometimes like, well, here I am, I am younger. I really ought to keep my mouth shut. And, you know, to a certain point, I respect what they're thinking. If they're thinking I'm among those who are older and wiser, I need to do some more listening. Okay. But we want them to ask questions, don't we? I want them to feel free. I want a Sunday morning class environment where a young person can raise his or her hand and say, I don't want to stir up any trouble at all. I just got a question. I don't understand why we say instruments are wrong. I want a class where a person can ask that without any fear. Don't you? I want a class environment where someone can raise their hand and say, you know, all my friends at school are saying baptism has nothing to do with salvation, and I was shown this verse, and I don't know what to do with it. And we talk about that stuff. And no one feels shamed. No one feels embarrassed. We are a family studying the Bible together. We can do it in the living room of our own home. We can do it in the meeting house. Let's not follow the wisdom of the world. God has designed it so that we've got intergenerational family, the best teaching tool for the young. And He's designed it so that the church should function as a family. Let's not do anything that undermines that. Let's not do anything that undermines that. I appreciate your attention tonight. We'll extend the gospel invitation. We are a family. There is a friend that sticks closer than a brother, a blood brother that is, and it's this family of God. I remember one sister who became a Christian while in college, and her parents were people of strong biblical conviction, but they're not members of the Lord's church. And they were struck by how now that she had become a part of this family, she could drive all the way across the country and she could have a place to sleep any night just because they were brethren. Her parents said to her, you know, I can't do that just because I can't just stop at somebody's house and stay there because we're members of the same church. She noticed the difference. There's a family here. If you are not a member of the family of God, can you explain why? And I'm sure you can. And when you explain why, is that reason any good? Sometimes it is cowardice that keeps us from becoming a Christian. Sometimes it's a love of the world. But none of it's going to be worth it when the Lord returns. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us at His coming. It's all the sacrifice is worth it. You can lose everything here, but you'll gain everything when the Lord returns. So if you're not ready to meet the Lord when He returns, and we can be of service to you tonight, please do come forward while we stand and sing.